Well, the session's over, and a special session may be in the wings. Upcoming in the fall, elections that might change the balance of power in the House, in the Senate, and perhaps in the governor's office. I'm Susan McGinnis for KUAC's Sunday at Noon. Last week, I spoke with Interior Republicans about these subjects, also about party politics in a state filled with independents, single-issue politics, and the direction of party politics in Alaska. Today, we turn to the views of Interior Democrats. Stay tuned as we speak with Betty Rollins. She is chairwoman of District 18. She ran for Senate against Senator Coghill in the last election. Catherine Reardon is a state central committee woman for District 19. She's also an aide to Representative Mike Davis and active in the Young Democrats. Jean Charney is with us. She is chairwoman for District 20. Nilo Kopanen, longtime member of the House of Representatives for District 21, running again in the next election. And Susan Callan, chairwoman for District 21 and vice chair for the Interior Democrats. Good afternoon and welcome, everyone. Glad
Hello.
You could take time.
Hi. Good afternoon, Susan.
All those voices are here. Now you know they're real. Nilo and Catherine, you were both in Juneau throughout the session. Catherine as an aide, Nilo, of course, as a representative. This session has been billed duly. On one side, it has been billed as the most productive term, two-year term, since 1976. And on the other hand, it has been billed as a session which lacked productivity, and charges have been let that nothing happened down there in Juneau. We need some responses to this.
I was wondering why I spent 12 to 14 hours a day, 7 days a week.
What were you doing?
It was unproductive.
Neil, let's have your view. Productive, non-productive, and why on each side?
I think it was productive. I think the perception that it was unproductive is due to the fact that we, in adopting the 120-day limit, did not require the both houses to have time enough to review legislation. So when the Senate tried its last-minute routine of dropping bills on us, and the minority decided to filibuster to hold up consideration of bills, especially hold up consideration of bills on the same day as from second to third reading, that did delay a lot of important bills that I consider important. And so that the final week was chaotic. But when you look at the, for that matter, this session itself, in perspective, even this session was productive, and the legislature, I think, was highly productive. It could have been more productive, but that is more institutional, the way we do things, and checks and balances sometimes end up in checking rather than balancing.
Mm-hmm. Catherine, your read on the session?
I would agree with Nilo that the session was productive. It was an average session, in my mind, that way. That there may be a need for some rules changes to change the process a little bit to allow for more consideration in a more deliberative way, but that there were a lot of important issues that were discussed very thoroughly, among which were some environmental legislation. The ethics issues were brought up and considered quite a bit, and I believe that some of these issues will lead to greater thought over the interim and activity next year, so it won't be for not just because bills died.
Bert Sharpe, I think, also cautioned us to remember that sessions do not end when sessions end. They go through the interim, and those who survive the election and those who come in anew consider past subjects again anew. Yeah. The two of you have both mentioned requiring more time for consideration. What changes can be made in rules to have that happen? What, for example, what bill should be offered up?
For example, in the theory of American bicameral legislation, both houses consider all the pieces of legislation and through the committee process, which does happen most of the year. But if we were to limit the consideration of bills to those that pass over before the last 30 days, and then consider conference committee and budget reports have to come in, say, 5 days before the end, that would make it more feasible. Of course, 20 years ago, the people of Alaska voted in referendum to fold the House and Senate together in a unicameral legislature, and the House concurred, but somehow the Senate did not. So we have to remember when we make rules changes, we have to have both houses agree, and the kind of leverage that they have with this last-minute thing makes it difficult for all of the senators to agree with, although I know individuals who would push it too.
One of the bills that did not get a full consideration, or at least reach a vote, I guess that's most accurate, is the bill regarding subsistence. We have in my ears, if you're listening out in your radio, a bit of a problem. It seems that it's coming on and off. Whatever it happened, it might happen again. Keep listening. One of the bills that didn't get through was a bill on subsistence. The Democratic Party, when it met in Nome in the last couple of weeks, did consider that issue and made a decision on it. Sue, do you want to speak to that?
Right. At our convention, we considered our party platform, and we added a new plank to the platform under the human rights portion that states that the Alaska Democratic Party supports a constitutional amendment to guarantee the traditional, customary, and necessary subsistence activities of rural Alaskans.
And that means to you what in terms of our Constitution? It means to Democrats what? And I'll open most of these questions to the table if someone would like to jump in.
What this platform,
Jean Charney,
does is it takes away the racial issue. It makes it a rural-urban issue. And we're supporting traditional lifestyle, which we have in Alaska. So that I think that's a real important. We definitely don't want a racial issue involved in this.
This is a native white issue. No,
in your mind, it is not. This is not a native white issue. This is subsistence. This is a lifestyle. This is surviving. And so we wanted to speak to it, so we put it in this platform. Another thing that I think is very important is that we do not need any more federal control of any Alaska state land.
Which raises the question of a special session. I'd like to get to that in the next few moments, yeah.
And I just think that it's very important that we deal with the issue rather than allow the federal government to step in and take over management on federal land.
Catherine Reardon, your comments here, please.
I would just echo what Jean mm-hmm. said, that it does seem clear to me that the federal government will take over management a fish and game on federal lands on July 1 unless an action is taken to either change federal law or the state constitution, and that I think it was only responsible for the Democrats to propose a solution to that dilemma, and I was very pleased they did at the convention.
Let me, for people who are just tuning in, remind you that we're talking to Interior Democrats today about the end of session, the upcoming special session or possibility thereof, elections coming up, and other issues relating to party politics. My guests today are Nilo Kopanen, representative for the House of Representatives for District 21, Susan Callan, chairwoman for District 21, Jean Charney, chairwoman District 20, Catherine Reardon, State Central Committee woman for District 19, and Betty Rollins, chairwoman for District 18. After a bit, we'll dispense with the titles and just go for names, since we do live in a small town. Nilo, what I would like from you is a read on what happened to subsistence during session, as well as the thought you have in mind. Can you begin with the one and then go to the other?
Well, essentially, there was a lot of lobbying, very direct lobbying. Members of the Alaska Outdoor Council, the leader of NRA, and others were down there lobbying against it in favor of the decision in the court decision in the Kenai case, which would open up access to all areas of the state.
In that case, for
even
people
even to people who are not resident in that area of the state. Now, so I think a lot of people were impressed with that. However, the Statehood Compact and Article 12, Section 12 of our own Constitution assigned to Congress the right to intervene on any claims, including fishing rights claims, that may have been made or may be made in the future on behalf of any native or native community. And ANILCA, essentially, and the Statehood Act and ANILCA took it to make it a rural, non-racial, rather than a native issue, because subsistence is the traditional way of living off the country, regardless of who you are or where you came from, so long as you're living out in the rural areas of the state. So if that's acceptable to Congress, I don't see why it can't be acceptable to Alaska. And I think that people did not realize that we had, in effect, by accepting statehood and by accepting our our own Constitution assigned that right to Congress. So there were a lot of arguments defending our Constitution against congressional interference, which a lot of people didn't bother reading the whole Constitution.
And so you're saying since the Constitution gives first rights in disputes to Congress anyway, if we stand stubbornly on common use, it's an ineffectual stand.
Yes, the important part of that is that Article 12, Section 12 doesn't just say federal land. I mean, that's what the feds are talking about now. It says in Alaska, including state lands and private lands. So I think that it is essential for us to deal with it now in Alaska and to keep out the long arm of the federal government. I mean, Congress may act without really knowing the situation. They've got a lot of other things to worry about, urban problems, price of corn in Nebraska, whatever. And they can pass a law that and give it to the bureaucracy or to deal with and foist something worse on us.
Any other thoughts on the issue of subsistence and... It's what do you think of it, the chances of a special session coming up? There was some question that Governor Cooper would not be able to muster the votes on subsistence and would have to pass on a special session.
Well, I voted for the subsistence amendment, and so I'm quite willing to go back there and try again, but I am not aware of the degree to which minds may be changed at this point.
Okay. How hard, last question, how hard do you think it'll be to wrest it away from the feds if the feds get it on July 1, if there's not a special session begun and completed in time?
Trying to get something away from the feds is awfully hard.
Once they get it.
Once they've got it, it's hard to get it back.
I want to turn to the question of the education endowment. It was proposed by Governor Cooper, pushed hard by him. It didn't get much, it wasn't well liked in some quarters. People didn't want to establish an endowment for any reason. People certainly didn't want to raid the permanent fund to get it. Others thought the endowment was an exceptionally good idea and the permanent fund was a good cash from which to take it. Thoughts from the Democratic Party or from members of the Democratic Party here gathered? Catherine Reardon, have you a thought to begin?
Sure. We did address the education endowment issue in our platform again this year. Susan Callan can read you the specific plank. The Fairbanks delegation as a whole, as I understand it, in the House, did support the education endowment when it came up for a vote and passed the House last year. I know that there are concerns about the permanent fund and using that as a funding source. I think that in general, the idea of putting aside money for education in the future is a very good one. Whether we should do it with the permanent fund earnings or with other sources of revenue wouldn't be so important to me personally. But I do believe that education is such an important right for future generations that it is something that we should be providing for at this point while we still have some money around.
There is a Republican charge that, or at least a charge from some parts of the Republican Party, that an educational endowment gives administration and teachers a ruddy pork barrel from which to sample, and that the education of children may actually suffer if you set aside a large amount of money. In other words, more money going to teachers, more money going to administration, less going into the classroom. Betty Rollins.
I believe it would give the administrators and our educational system a better idea of what kind of money they had, and then they would know in advance how much money was coming in, and they could better budget. This, I don't see where it would do any harm.
Susan? Callan?
I would just like to say that in the platform, we didn't say where the money would come from. The Democratic Party supported the establishment of an education endowment fund, and then we had two or three other planks which urged the increase in funding for all levels of education from early childhood through the post-secondary level without specifically saying where the funding would come from.
Have you, has anyone looked ahead to see where, if not the permanent fund, it might come from? There's that gloomy shadow of declining revenues always at our back. Catherine,
well,
your thoughts?
We could always set aside a certain amount of general fund revenue. Every year we could set aside some of the money from the outstanding lawsuits over oil taxes. There should be some fairly large settlements coming that we, if not for the education endowment, should probably be putting aside for some later purpose. So there are other sources other than the permanent fund, I believe.
And the claims on these monies from other hungry hands?
Well, that's something difficult about budgeting. There are always lots of legitimate needs, and the role of our elected officials is to try to decide between a lot of very legitimate needs. The idea that there is a lot of fat, things that can be removed without any loss of service or assistance to Alaskans, I don't think is really the answer to our upcoming problems. We're going to have to make hard choices. And cut not just fat, but into the muscle in some cases. So that's just politics and elected government.
You're listening to Sunday at Noon. Today we're talking with Vox Populi, the Democrats, the voice of the people. Nilo, you had a thought about the endowment.
Yes. I think one of the things that I hate to drag the feds in again, but we do have...
Go right ahead. They're not here.
Right. But Congress has, through the years, mandated three trust funds. One was the Mental Health Trust, which is unique to Alaska, the income from 100,000 acres, and we're currently arguing about that. And the, under the Morrell Act, the land-grant colleges were set up, and we're sitting in one right now, the land-grant college.
Yes.
And then the public school fund, which essentially sets aside the income from 5.5% of lands in the state. This is the lands resources, including Prudhoe Bay. And we've been sued, the state has been sued twice, once on the university lands and once on the mental health trust lands, and lost both lawsuits. The third one in waiting is the public school fund lands. We've been putting the money into the permanent fund, which lawyers tell me creates the permanent fund as a trustee in fact. That's the term they use.
And that means?
For the public school trust. So if we don't fund the public school trust fund by some other means, the lawyers are going to be perfectly happy to go into the permanent fund, and it's not going to be, and I'd much rather see the legislature deal with that than see the judges and the lawyers argue it out.
Fascinating. I wonder if it's a good time to move on to budget, since we're talking about monies and set aside. And Catherine, you just mentioned not just the fat, but the muscle. The Republicans here gathered last weekend were saying this is the near $3 million that was approved by both houses just at the end of the session was one of the largest budgets we've had since pipeline days, and that the darn thing may just continue to grow until we simply run out of money, in which case we will cut past muscle to bone. Was the legislature far too generous with itself this session? Are we in danger of building programs that we will later have to cut even more deeply? I open it to the table.
Well, one of the areas that grew, of course, were the capital funds, and those fluctuate according to needs and ability. And, for example, for the University of Alaska, just for the Fairbanks campus alone, we got some $36.5 million in capital funds, many of which were needed, deferred maintenance, all kinds of repairs over the campus. But the natural sciences facility, $23 million plus about $2 million in interest. And we'll have to go back for another $2.5 million to finish that. But there are going to be needed programs that will take place there, but we already have the funding for that. We also increased the operating budget increment 1.7 million here in Fairbanks, and I think we can probably sustain that level. But the point is, you know, you have 1.7 operating increases against a 36.5 capital. The capital is not always a recurring expense, so that's where a good deal of the increase went. education and mental health funds, substance abuse programs, those were ones. Hopefully something like the substance abuse one, if we find solutions and decrease the use of alcohol and other things, that also can go down.
Catherine?
Yes. I may make one comment about the budget, and that is, yes, our budget is larger per capita than many other states. I don't believe that that is because of inefficiency. I think we have a lot of services and programs that are needed here and may not be in states with more infrastructure and a little bit older states. And also we have programs that they may not have other states, but which are very needed, which provide for the needy or, you know, the young, things like that. And one of my experiences as an aide every year has been in receiving all of the requests after Representative Davis reads them and directs me in how to respond. All the capital requests, we received, I think, 170 million or over capital requests from the Fairbanks area. And to everyone, their request is very important and reasonable, and most of them are, and justifiable. And it's other people's programs, perhaps, or projects that might be seen as fat. There are a lot of good things that government could do out there, and a lot of competing interests. And I would say that every program and capital project that is proposed does have a constituency. I don't think the government goes out and does that many things that no one's calling for. Mm-hmm. Now, balancing those requests and realizing that they can't all be met is very important and will be as revenues decline. But we receive a tremendous number of very serious, well-intentioned requests from the Fairbanks community.
Neela, one last question on the budget. Do you think that when the belt tightening comes, it will come like it did in 1985 with a vengeance? Or do you think that we're going to, 86, do you think we're going to have a decline to which the houses will have to respond?
Well, there are two kinds of decline. 86 decline was a sudden fluctuation in the price of oil, and actually we overreacted. People projected that the fall in the price of oil during the August of 86 is going to continue. By the time we went back into session, we found that we'd shot ourselves in the foot by allowing the governor to cut so broadly. It certainly hurt the university very badly. So we tend to overreact both to sudden rises and falls, and since about 85% of our budget comes from the oil that we sell to the oil companies and the taxes on the oil companies too. And the other is the long-term decline. There is a secular decline in the production of Prudhoe Bay, and hopefully we'll find other field. But we've known of this we've known of this from the beginning, you know. Mm-hmm. That reservoir is limited. So part of the reason for setting up the permanent fund was to provide an offset, and we're looking at other ways of the budget reserve fund that we passed this year, which the public should vote for, sets aside a reserve for the budget to create some stability in the case of a sudden decline, so that we're looking at these. We also, in the long term, probably will have to entertain other sources of income. On Catherine's point, I'd like to point out that our pride in Alaska is partly the size of Alaska, but if you've ever driven, and all of you have, the Alaska Highway, you realize there's mile after mile of nothing but mile after mile, and maintaining those many miles of road costs money. And I think that's, if we were Rhode Island, our highway maintenance costs would be much lower, and we would have more people to pay for it. And so that's one of the facts to bear in mind, that we're a small number of people scattered over a vast territory. That's one of the reasons that government is so costly.
Yeah, if I could just say one thing to that.
Susan Callan.
I was just looking through, I'm Susan Callan, through the Democratic platform, and we have a very large platform on human needs. And I think that part of what a lot of us believe in is balancing that human needs issues of health and increased funding for early childhood education, for elderly care, for just health and welfare of our people as over against cutting into a budget. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that there's a philosophy which says, well, we must provide health, education, even sewer and water for the people who are residents and citizens of our state, and that the budget should address things like this. And I think that's important.
Is your sense that the Democratic Party would support a return to an income tax or other form of taxation in the state? I know it's a hard question.
Rather than
slash services to the bone?
I can say my very personal view. I'm Susan Callan from District 21, and I personally would support a return to a state income tax. I would also like to point out that one thing the Democrats have come out for is for some kind of national health insurance program, which is another thing which is along those lines.
Mm-hmm. On Jean the Charney. Tax, I thought we never should have gotten rid of the income tax. We should have in place an income tax now and all through the years, especially during pipeline construction, that allowed for credits for residents, yes. Credits for utility bills, things like that, so that residents would really have a reduced tax rate. But non-residents who make these huge amounts of money and take all of it and leave, the snowbird, so to speak, would be taxed. You wouldn't have, I mean, it's a great source of revenue if you built an income tax system with credits for residents.
It's getting a lot of nods around the table. Is this the kind of thing that this state might institute, say, prior to the mythical gas line?
I would like to see it.
I would like
great
to see
idea.
It.
Mm-hmm.
Susan, Susan just spoke. Catherine Reardon again.
I would like to say that I think there is a wide range of thoughts within the Democratic Party, just like Alaska, on the issue of income taxes. Personally, I don't think it's the time now yet for an income tax. I believe it will come eventually. But I think that we should wait for an income tax until we're down to a point where people feel comfortable with their government and what services they're trading off for the tax. Because I think that people will be willing to pay for things when they realize exactly what they are, and what the trade-off is, but I think it's several years before we really need to seriously consider an income tax, because I think we do have space within the budget and revenues for the next couple years. I don't think it's yet the time, and wouldn't want to portray the Democratic Party as saying yes, income tax now.
I wonder if things ever become that clean. You said when it gets to the point where the people are comfortable with the level of government versus the amount they have to pay for that government. I mean,
there'll always be people who dissent.
Right. Hundreds of thousands of opinions running around the state on that issue. Nilo Kopanen.
I did introduce a bill in order to start the discussion, because I think that's what we need to have is a public discussion on it. And my bill calls for 100% dollar-for-dollar offset for local taxes, property taxes and the like that we pay. The result would be, as Jean suggested, essentially taxing the people who do not live in Alaska, because they wouldn't get that offset. And
but if I paid $400 in property tax on my house, right. That would be set against my taxes.
We have to have other. I mean, that isn't enough, because we have a lot of people that live here who don't own property.
Right.
And so we need things like utility bills and things that everybody has to pay in our credit system.
Yeah, we took a portion of the Oregon State Tax Code that gives people an offset on property taxes on their rental. You can calculate that. That was a part of that. And there are the other recaptures that we can do. It would have yielded about $200 million because the tax rate was very low. It was just calculated on the federal tax rate, so you wouldn't have to supply two things. And it's interesting, the Anchorage delegation, Republican and Democrat alike, essentially opposed it. The rural and southeastern ones supported the idea. The bill did not pass. I didn't expect it to. But we had support from some of the people who worked in Alaska from Oregon. Oregon taxes the revenue of people who work outside of the state, you know, regardless of sources, except when there is a state income tax. So they would have kept more of their income paying this minor Alaskan income tax than they do currently. The people from Washington, of course, who worked up here didn't like the idea. They don't pay any.
Right. We're talking today with Nilo Kopanen, whose voice you just heard. Jean Charney is with us, Susan Callan, Catherine Reardon, and Betty Rollins, all representatives from the Interior Democrats. One of the bills that did not make it through House and Senate but got a great deal of discussion this year was a bill on ethics. From a Democratic perspective, do we need one? Do we not need one? Some of the Republicans that I spoke with last week said essentially that if we elect people who are ethical, those people will remain ethical once they are in the House and Senate, and that a restrictive ethics bill or legislation would also be restrictive within the houses. I'm not sure whether I'm saying that quite as clearly as they did, but essentially, no, they did not want an ethics bill. Your response is, Democrats, do we need to govern the ethics of our representatives? Jean Charney, your thoughts? Betty Rollins,
I don't think you can argue with what the Republicans stated. If you send an ethical person to the legislature, they will remain ethical. However, I think there may be a need for an ethics bill, but the bill that they put in place this year was not a well-thought-out bill. I think the study itself was flawed. I read the study and the report of that study. I don't see how the man... He asked specific questions. He asked the legislators, the lobbyists, and government employees, which I don't consider the mainstream people. He gave them a questionnaire, and I think he probably got 100, I think it's close to 100 questionnaires returned. I don't see where he got his report from the answers. He talked about honorariums. Nilo, when's the last time you got an honorarium? We're not talking about the lower 48. I think that perhaps if we do have an ethics bill, I know there is talk of having hearings throughout the summer. It should be well thought out. It shouldn't be bringing some high-priced consultant in from the lower 48 who does not understand Alaska, asking questions only from three groups of people, mm-hmm. and coming out with a report where I have no idea. It's ridiculous. I don't know where he got that from. I would like to see something in place. I would like to see more people involvement in it, however.
Citizens,
me.
Okay. I understand there was another report or a study being done by a committee that is due to meet over the summer. Is that the case? Jean is pointing at Nilo.
Yeah.
There is an interstate group called the Council on Governmental Ethics Legislation.
Yes.
It involves some 40 states, and we've had for the past 2 years an invitation to them, which they accepted, to meet in Anchorage in September. And we were to work with them on looking at the existing legislation, the conflict of interest, campaign financing, all of the things that sort of would fit into an ethics bill. And that was in that process is continuing. It was in place before the Josephson report came in from the Senate. And in fact, there were a couple of pieces of legislation which sort of got swallowed up, one of which I thought had a chance of passing, and that was the campaign finance reform bill. And I think the ethics bill, in a way, because it was so global and dropped in so late, helped kill campaign financing reform, as well as holding up some of the spill bills and other legislation. So, I mean, a cynic might say that the ethics bill was an unethical attempt to hold up other legislation.
Catherine Reardon, your thoughts on this matter?
Yeah, I have just a few comments on the ethics bill. I am the aide to the chairman of the current ethics committee, and so I followed the bill a fair amount. I do believe new ethics legislation is needed. I think that that there were serious problems with the bill as it was presented in early April from the consultant, constitutional questions, drafting problems. It was a very kind of mixed up, messy thing when it came to us, and that further complicated the difficulty in dealing with it in a short period of time, along with the length. But I think that it served a purpose in really getting attention focused on ethics, and I know that Representative Davis and Senator Porcheau have been discussing having public hearings during the interim, starting with maybe the bill as groundwork and seeing how the public feels about it. The reason I believe that ethics legislation is needed is because it isn't as simple as perhaps people felt last week from the Republican Party, as ethical people will behave ethically, unethical ones won't, and you just have to make sure you elect the correct ones. Because issues in ethics legislation are things like disclosure of your sources of income. That isn't something that would be unethical not to do in your personal life if you're a regular citizen. It's something that needs to be discussed more on the level of, is this something that the public needs to know? And mm-hmm. then you pass legislation if you believe it should be. Honoraria. I agree that honoraria is very rare in the Alaska legislature, but perhaps we should deal with it to prevent a situation from developing, in Washington, D.C., where it became a major source of congressmen's income. If we say you may not accept honoraria now, it won't get to be a tradition that people will count on. The campaign finance sections of the ethics bill, I thought, were the crucial portions. They could be addressed either in separate campaign finance legislation that was already in the legislature or as part of an ethics package. Once again, that's not something where you would say someone was wrong to follow our current campaign finance laws, an unethical person, but that maybe we need to change, further modify the way we do business. Anyway, there are a number of things like that. I think it takes discussion and public decision-making about how elected officials should behave in comparison to regular private citizens. So that would be my comment.
Thank you, Catherine. And Neela, just a second. I wanted to point out that not everyone at the table last week thought it was a matter of either you elect the right people or you don't. Mm-hmm. Bert Sharpe's opinion was, he also stated that he felt the ethics bill was not finished yet and it needed more work.
Okay.
And there was yet another opinion at the table. Don't want to leave people poorly stated on my end of the business here. Neela, your thoughts?
I just want to bring up the point that I made earlier, that procedures, how we consider bills, when we consider them, if you have procedures that allow for a sort of traffic jam for some powerful person to hold up bills, for example, mm-hmm. that is quite apart from the ethical question. Good people can't operate with bad procedures. Bad people can screw up good procedures, but nevertheless, we would do a lot better if we just rewrote our rules so that things could be considered in a timely manner and that we had more public input, and that we would look at the results of some of these things beforehand, like the passage of 120-day session, which I'm very grateful for because it got me home, but the fact that you get a bill at 1/2 minute to midnight and you have to vote for it was not a good or comfortable feeling either.
Which is something that can be taken care of in rules. Can the problem of holding bills hostage also be taken care of by a rewriting of the procedures? I don't want to let it out of my committee because I don't want to let it into your committee, so I'm not going to move it. And then you decide, well, it happened this year. Betty Fahrenkamp held up the ban on fish farming. The sponsors of that bill were so enraged, I think is probably a decent word for it, that they decided to cut off all funding for the Healy power plant. So who was holding whose breath until who turned blue?
Right, yeah. I think it's impossible to hear all bills adequately. That's one of the things. Maybe the process of bill introduction might be thought of differently. I've heard a lot of simple-minded ideas. You know, you can only put in a certain limited number of bills, mm-hmm. regardless of, you know, last-minute emergencies or realities of the situation. Some states have a procedure by which petitions are heard before bills are written up. Yes, something needs to be done, but I don't want to dash into some, simple-minded, immediate solution.
Right. It's a problem, maybe long-term. I want to jump into the election. There are already ads on the television. Have you folks been watching and listening? It's upon us.
We have been too nice to watch.
We have many things opening up. The governor's office is opening up. Lieutenant governor's office in our area, one Senate seat will be open. The House in its entirety opens wide and in some cases disgorges some people. We have some people who aren't going to be running anymore. And we've also got national elections for one in the Senate and one in the House. I want to start with a general thought from whomever would like to answer on Democrats getting ready for these elections. Does anybody want to challenge Ted Stevens and Don Young? That can the Democratic Party challenge these two long-term office holders? How do you feel about the governor's office? How do you feel about the question mark, fill in the blank? Ladies and gentlemen, your thoughts? Jean Charney, first.
We have a very good candidate for the United States House of Representatives.
Don Young's seat.
And in John Devens. And one of the points that he makes is that any Democrat elected to Congress would automatically have more power than any Republican.
Because of the balance of power.
No matter how long they've served. Because Republicans are in the minority party, the Democrats are the majority party. And you can say you've been there and you're a high-ranking minority, but you're still a minority. And you can't accomplish very much. So we do have a very good candidate there. And I don't, and right now we don't have a strong candidate for Ted's seat.
Mm-hmm. There was some thought among the Republicans here gathered last week that there is no cap on sessions, either sessions on terms, either within the state or in national elections, and there should be a limit on terms. It's been talked about locally. What do you people think about limiting terms, not just because there are three Republicans now representing us in Washington, but for any reason? Jean again. Jean Charney.
Well, I wrote down some points on that. I think a better solution than limiting terms would be some limits on spending in an election campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is any legislator that's in office, if you know it's his last term, will not have any effect. He will not be effectual. Another thing is you're taking away, if you're looking just at the state, you're taking away the Bush vote. The Bush notoriously elects representatives to the state that over and over and over again, that know the way to operate, that know how to function in Juneau and can get things done for the Bush. And you're taking that away if you limit the term. Another point is you're taking away the people's choice. If a person wants to vote for a person, no matter how many terms that person served, people have the right to vote for that person. So those are some of the
rebuttal
things.
In the room? Or not?
I don't think I don't
Betty
agree
Rollins.
With I agree with the limiting terms. Main reason, if you get an incumbent down there, it's almost impossible for someone to come in and knock off an incumbent.
I don't know what in national elections there's something like a 99% return
right.
in the last election.
But that's one of my points though. If you limit spending, you'll yeah. limit a lot of what Betty's objecting to.
Okay, Betty,
the incumbent has the name recognition. They know the people, whereas someone coming in trying to take over that seat, because they feel that person is not effective for the people of their community. You can say all day that they're not effective. You can bring out circumstances, but unless you have the people power behind you, mm-hmm. and you don't get money from your organizations. You don't get money from, say, the teachers' lobby, because they want to be on the side of the incumbent. You don't get the support of the people, even though they might believe in some of the things you're saying. The special interest groups, and people say you can deal without special interest money. You cannot in our mm-hmm. state. Running a campaign is extremely expensive. The incumbent has a name recognition. They have the bucks behind them. They generally have some kind of an organization. A new person can get a few people in that want to work on their campaign, but not the organization that an incumbent can get. And there may be many, many valid reasons why you want to take that incumbent out, not just because Democrat and Republican,
mm-hmm.
but valid reasons. But you don't have the chance to even get that voice out because you don't have the money behind you and you don't have the support or the organization, and it's very difficult to get it.
Okay, Betty Rollins says limit those sessions. Add your voice, Sue Kelly.
Yeah, I think this is a place where the parties can play a very much larger role than perhaps in some cases they do. For example, if you have in a particular district a very, very good, effective, say, Democratic legislator, and you would like them to go on forever because they are your man, they support your values, they vote for your issues, they bring in money for your district, if you had a limit on the term, if you also had the party in place bringing in new people, new candidates, new people to be trained along in the system, so that when they got to perhaps make them an aide for a couple of terms to the existing legislators, so they would get to know the ropes in Juneau, so that they would have a funding organization, people to work for them. You could have your parties, I think, in this situation, play a much larger role than they do now, and you could bring along good people, and you wouldn't have this such quite a disproportionate advantage to the incumbent if you already had your party structure working to bring in new representatives, new senators.
And nor would you have the situation that of...
Well, you'd have your support group there.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking of if Ted Stevens and Don Young lose at some future date, their position and influence will be literally ripped away from both the state and Washington. However, I mean, however you read that influence, may be very large, it may be very small in one's perception, but nonetheless, it will be yanked out of wherever it is. Jean Charney, your thoughts
here?
Well,
that's the point that I want, you know, that's where we can deal with, because in Washington, D.C. is where seniority really matters. Yeah, we do a lot of changing in our state legislature. So we don't have the ingrained incumbents in our state legislature that you have in the national Congress. And if we had a limit, I mean a national limit on spending, that would make a big difference with incumbency at the national level. Also, if you're talking Ted Stevens and Murkowski and Don Young, seniority, then you're back to the other point that I made, that they don't have the influence that they would have if they were in the majority party.
This is another ongoing discussion, isn't it, for the entire state of Alaska and what we want to do. I want to turn, if you'll let me, to the wide open House. With the House and seats in the Senate that are opening up, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, the balance of power could shift. Democrats have had fairly strong majority, although with the coalition relationships it's faltered now and then. But the Democrats have had a fairly strong majority in the House. The Republicans a fairly strong one in the Senate. Things could topple, reverse themselves, or maintain themselves. As Democrats looking at an election coming up, do you have an agenda? Do you have interests to pursue here? I open it to the floor. Jean Charney again.
Well, I know that when we were in Nome for our state convention, we did discuss the just different districts of the state, and we have the Democratic parties are putting forth some very good candidates, and so I mean that's where we can start, and we work hard to win the election, and hopefully our Democratic candidates will win the seats that are being vacated.
Is it unusual for 9 people to retire, to step
yeah,
out
actually,
and decide not to come back?
The Senate is the body where you're in for 4 years, and it's a smaller body. It has a very slow turnover rate compared to the House. Actually, over the long term, about one-third of the House turns over, and that's fairly common through the years. Right now, we have roughly one-quarter, 9 legislators who are not choosing to run again. So, but that's, even though it's a greater number of people leaving, that's really not that much of a turnover if they're not replaced. I expect they will be. The House Democratic Campaign Committee every year holds training sessions for people and who come to Juneau and observe the legislature and work with legislators for a time. I think the Republicans do something of the same sort. And although there was a decline in interest, we still had over 20 people participate, 24, counting aides. And so that there will be candidates. For example, Mike Davis has decided not to run, but we have 2 excellent candidates on the Democratic side, either of whom I'd be proud to work with and, in fact, have worked with in a campaign before. So I think that's an important point. I think that both parties are preparing to fight fairly hard to maintain their position. The Senate is almost always a coalition. Our rules, our constitutional rules, really require two-thirds or three-quarter votes on a number of cases. So in the Senate, it's almost inevitable that there's a coalition.
That's a coalition.
And
yeah.
Party issues move to the background. In the House, we're usually willing to try to work with the minority and therefore don't try to go into coalition in all questions. But our failure to go into coalition was one of the reasons the minority was able to delay consideration of bills in the last session. Mm-hmm. But I still think it was better to hold it fairly firm the way we did. Incidentally, going back to John Devens, people may not remember, but he was here in the late 60s and early 70s as an audiologist for Alaska Crippled Children and Adults. And I was the principal at Barnett School at the time, and he was the one who identified the problem of otitis media among children in interior Alaska. So he's got quite a career outside of being mayor of Valdez, and a very useful member of this community. He was one who left, but is still in Alaska.
I want to turn us, if we can, to, again, a general question. We live in a state where some 50%, and my numbers sometimes are off, but close to that, are independents, registered as independents, or nonpartisan.
60%.
60%? Even more. And yet we have the traditional Republican and Democrat parties, strong unto themselves, not necessarily strong voices among the electorate, which is to say you can't convince 60% of the people to make a decision one way or the other, or the libertarians would also be counted in that camp. How does it feel to be a Democrat in a place where 60% of the voters around you are independents? Does it matter much to you? I had a Bert Sharp saying that some survey of voters indicated that most of that 60% voted Republican.
I have the exact opposite.
Oh, good. Now for survey number two. Jean Charney, your thoughts, please.
Well, I haven't done any that I know of a survey, but that I know a lot of independents, registered independents, and they value the fact that they are a registered independent rather than registered to any particular party. But almost everyone I know that's an independent votes Democratic, votes for the Democratic candidates, except on a rare occasion. But they want to, they feel they need to preserve their option to vote any way they want to, even though they can register with any party and still have their freedom to vote any way they want to. But they just have, they value their independence.
So, Karen.
Just a pitch for parties here. I think that a reason some of us do choose to join a party and to proclaim that is that we stand for a set of values that are very important. And we publish these sets of values called a platform. And in there we have our stances on human rights, on labor and management, on international and national affairs. And I think these are important issues to us, and the fact that we do publish them, the fact that we do stand behind them, and that we hold to them, makes a statement as to who we are and what we believe and how we think the nation, the state, the community should best be managed, governed, to make it the best place to live in. And I think I can understand people wanting independence, but I would urge them, if they care to take some of these issues and make them their own in the way that they do vote, that they go ahead and join the party so that they in fact say, this is what I stand for and this is important to me.
I would like to second that. I was an independent for many years before I became a Democrat. I studied both parties. The Democratic Party gave me a philosophy. It gave me a voice. And of course, when we get together, we do argue. But when the party says, okay, this is the way it's going to be, we have our voice. I understand why people are independents. Not because they don't want to be part of a philosophy, but a lot of people out there just say, hey, nobody's going to tell me what to do. But our parties do not really tell you what to do or how to think. At least the Democratic Party doesn't. But you do have a voice. And it took me a long time to decide to take a party rather than being a Democrat or a Republican, because it was something ingrained in me. I had been independent for so many years. It took me a month of very hard study. But I am not sorry. Mm-hmm. I'm very happy I became a Democrat, and it does fill a need within me.
Catherine Reardon, quick thought from you.
Yeah, I'd like to say that I think that parties play a very positive role in state government in that they clarify the issues. If everyone is acting as an individual voter, which is positive in one way, there is not an organization to be bringing issues to the fore, debating them in a kind of comprehensive way. I also think that the parties, by working together with other people on political issues, it gives somewhere for our elected officials to come to get some response to how we feel about issues. Personally, as a younger Democrat, it's allowed me to get involved in politics and learn about politics. The party educates the members and also elected officials about how your rank and file Fairbanksons are feeling. I'm afraid that without parties, we would be voting just on single issues rather than having any philosophy put forward that people could respond to.
Can I give one? The problem is, it's got a long answer, I'm sure, and we've only got 2 minutes left for it. Should the party, the primary system right now, is very comfortable for independents. Should it be made less comfortable for independents? Jean Charney.
What the Democrats would like to see is going back to the system that we had in effect until 1967, which is any registered voter can request any party's ballot. So you're not limited when you go
But
to
I can't
vote.
Have both.
But you can't have both, that's right. Yeah. But we don't want it, we want it determined by the legislature or by a popular vote. We don't want it determined by a few people in a party with a party rule. So that's where we stand on that.
Last thought,
I was going to say that I follow the same sort of evolution as Betty did, from a very stubborn independent to a dedicated Democrat, working my way up through the party ranks as a precinct chair and finally on the state committee. But the collective decision-making in the legislature requires groupings of people, and it's better that their people work together and share a common philosophy, whether Republican or Democratic. And I have to say that I depend very much on letters and public opinion messages from people. The typical independent who writes me is interested in one or two immediate issues. The Democrats, on the other hand, are interested in a broader gamut of issues, and so are the Republicans, too.
Interesting.
The people who are active politically, and this is of all parties, are at least have a broader view, and they look at more issues. And I have to say the Democratic rank and file in District 21 are my eyes and ears in the community. So I depend very much on them, to not only for their opinions, but what mm-hmm. they can tell me about what the community feeling is.
Oh, thank you, Nilo. I want to thank you all. We've got just seconds left, so it's enough time for people, for me, to remind listeners who you are and from where you hail. Betty Rollins is chairwoman for District 18. She ran for Senate against Senator Coghill in the last time out. Now, again, chairwoman for District 18. Thanks for joining us, Betty. Catherine Reardon, State Central Committee woman for District 19, has been an aide to Representative Mike Davis for his last term. He's now retiring, at least for the interim. She is also active in the Young Democrats and feels that is a good place to serve and for other people to join, yes? Jean Charney, chairwoman for District 20. Susan Callan, chairwoman for District 21 and vice chair to the statewide Interior Democrats Party. Sorry, thanks, Susan. Nilo Kopanen, also with us, long-term member of the House of Representatives, serving District 21. This has been an hour with the Democrats, taking a look at issues important to all of us relative to our state, the last session, the upcoming special session, and inevitably the general election coming up in November. I'm Susan McGinnis. Please join me next week on Sunday at noon when we will sit down to with Emory Elliott. Dr. Elliott was the general editor for the Columbia Literary History of the United States, which was published in 1988. The last literary history was published in 1948. One of the distinguishing factors for this book is that it routinely includes the works of Native Americans, Hispanics, Asians, Blacks, and white women among its writers. I think you will find it an interesting hour. If you can heft the 1,199-page book, I think you will find it an interesting book. Join me at the very least next Sunday on Sunday at Noon. You're listening to KUAC-FM in Fairbanks.